So unless I hear otherwise to not do so, I'm going to read each question out. They are bulky questions. So if people are excited about speaking themselves and you don't want me to read all the what each question is, I don't have to do that. But out of respect to the writers of the questions, I would like to read them at this point. Unless I hear otherwise to not do so, that's what I'm going to do. So question one is, in anti-juring, Engels writes that the transformation either into joint stock companies or into state ownership does not do away with the capitalist nature of the productive forces. How, then, can he also write, the proletariat turns the means of production in the first instance into state property, but in doing this, it abolishes all class distinctions and class antagonisms, abolishes also the state as state. Could he have plausibly meant that these things are abolished simply by virtue of the fact that different people, the proletariat, are the agents of transformation? If not, refer to the surrounding text to explain what he did mean. Over. This is me again. This is Stephanie. I'm not hearing a response out there in Skype land. Is anyone there willing to initiate a response for question number one? Over.
Toralf?
Right, Toralf. Go ahead. If anyone else wants to get on the stack for answering when Toralf has finished his response, just let me know. Over.
Well, I thought that the means of production, by the time the revolutionaries they take over, the proletariat takes over, the means of production are already socialized at the national or state level. So, which means that the proletariat only needs to seize political power, and when that happens, they already have the means of production as they are at the top level. And then the other one, abolishes state as state, that means that the state as the agent and the protector of capital, the old state, as the agent and the protector of capital no longer exists. And all class antagonisms are abolished because private ownership of the means of production is abolished, and therefore the opposites of wage earner and capitalist are abolished. So, and the agricultural work as well as the service sector work, they all count as wage labor as well. So that's what I thought. Over.
Hi, Sudeep here.
Great, go ahead, Sudeep.
I think Toralf is right, except that, I mean, I guess when the productive forces and all the means of production are socialized, I guess the proletariat no longer remains a proletariat because the class distinction is abolished. And I think Engels also somewhere mentions that when this happens, then the government of persons is replaced with the administration of things. I guess by that very, with that having been achieved, I guess the state no longer, the state is not abolished, but just, I guess, withers away. Over.
Thank you both. Anyone else?
Please, Jay. Yeah?
Can I clarify which Peter, did you say Peter J. wants to speak now? Is that you? Over.
B. the English one. I think the other Peter's Australian, judging by his accent. The English Peter, yeah?
Oh, English Peter, as in Peter Glover, right?
Yeah.
Or English Peter. Whoops. Okay, yeah, never mind. Okay, I'll be careful with that. Thank you. Over.
I mean, there's a bit of... the last, near the end of that section, theoretical, in Anti-Turing, I've got this Progress Publishers edition, and it's 345 on that, but if you've got an internet edition, it will be in the last, you know, the last, maybe the last section three of that, which is probably the second, third last paragraph. But in this, Engels says this, he says, proletarian revolution, solution of the contradictions. The proletariat seizes the public power, and by means of this, transforms the socialized means of production, slipping from the hands of the bourgeoisie, into public property. By this act, I wonder, that's my emphasis. The proletariat frees the means of production from the character of capital they have thus far borne. Blah, 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 a little bit extra. Then socialized production upon a predetermined plan henceforth becomes possible. The development of production makes the existence of different classes of society thenceforth an anachronism. So it appears, I mean, there's a kind of, I know the question implies that, you know, a different answer. But I just glanced near the end, I thought, well, how can you contradict these two different aspects of what Engels appears to be saying? Because it appears to be saying, listen, we need to seize political power, then socialise the means of production, and that will kind of, after a short period, do away with classes. I mean, that's the interpretation of that paragraph. I don't know whether anyone's got another interpretation, but it kind of looks a bit slightly contradictory to the part that was mentioned in the question. Over.
Great, thank you. Anyone else?
Over. Hi, this is Ruchira.
Go ahead. Thank you.
What I wanted to say is, I think that I don't know if there's a contradiction, because the role of the state is possibly to, you know, be in this transformation period, like it's supposed to transform an erstwhile capitalist state which the workers have seized over and make it into a, you know, socialist state, and then it is supposed to sort of automatically degenerate. That's the idea. Except that, you know, what happens in praxis is that all these, the workers will go take over political power or something, and then they'll find that they have production relations that are not really capitalist production relations to deal with. For instance, they'll have the kulaks sitting around, or they'll have the old landlords having a lot of power, or the aristocrats having power. And then it gets confusing, like, what is the state supposed to do, or what, I mean, are they supposed to bring about capitalism? Clearly not, or are they? We don't know. So, yeah, what does the work of a revolutionary party become? That becomes the question.
Stephanie?
Whoops, I'm sorry, I forgot to mute, I think. I am here, Andrew, what's up? Andrew, we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yes, we can. I can.
Okay. I'd like to speak.
Go for it.
Yeah, I think the interpretations have mostly the interpretations that have been given so far don't remove the apparent contradiction. What you have, it seems to me, on the basis of this conception, is different people in charge of the means of production. But that does not, they're in charge of the state, they're in control of the state, but that does not do away with the capitalist nature of the productive forces. So the question is, what does? The mere fact that there's a different group in control doesn't do it, according to that first statement of Engels. Okay? Because he it's a state ownership. So it's not a question of who is in control of the state. State ownership does not do away with the capitalistic nature of the productive forces. So I think it's other things that he's talking about that do. And he says that this, you know, act of the proletariat is its last act as proletariat. And there is going to be established a classless society right at that point. Now, the moment there's a classless society, okay, which is not, that can't be, first of all, can't be synonymous with state ownership, okay, but if there's a classless society, that is part of what is needed to do away with the capitalist character of the productive forces, obviously. You know, if you don't have classes, you don't have capital, and the productive forces are then no longer capital. But he goes a little bit further, and at the end of the thing that we were reading, the next to the last paragraph, he says, production of commodities is done away with. Okay? So I think that that is definitely a part of what one needs to get rid of the capitalistic nature of the productive forces, because the production of capital was a further development and a form of the production of commodities, and simultaneously the mastery of the product over the producer. This is a, you know, major concept of Volume 1 of Capital. You know, it appears, for instance, right at the end of Chapter 1, the section on the fetishism of the commodity, that we're ruled by the products of our own hands. And there's a lot involved in that that he doesn't go into, but I think that that's really important. And that's not, you know, that doesn't end automatically just by changing the title of ownership of a bunch of stuff. And then he says, anarchy in social production is replaced by systematic, definite organization. Okay, and so forth and so on. So there's a series of things that I think that he has in mind that actually do the work of making the productive forces no longer capital, rather than the state ownership. Over.
Thank you, Andrew. Anyone else on question one?
Over. Anne?
Go ahead, Anne.
Yeah, I agree with Andrew. Maybe this whole thing is not as well written as we would like, but I think if we've done all the readings on this subject, not to mention some of the rest of Marx, that we couldn't possibly think he means that by taking over the state, or even by taking over ownership of the means of production, that alone is sufficient to do away with class society and put the proletariat in a new position vis-a-vis everything. And I think that last or next to the last paragraph of the section that Andrew was reading demonstrates that very much. Production of commodities is done away with. That's, of course, the key to what capitalism is. Production of commodities, the first page of Capital Volume 1, and it's thereby that it's the end of the mastery of the product over the producer. So that relationship is completely changed, and everything's different. So I think that we sort of had it sort of backwards, that it's the proletariat seizing control of society and everything in it that changes everything, and then changes the state and changes private property, does away with private property and everything. Can't be the other way around. It can't come down from the state or down of any kind of state, and it can't just result in another state with similar functions. He's the one that has the oft-quoted line about the withering way, the way of the state, or in my translation, it dies out. This might be in question two. It is, so I'll stop. Over.
Anyone else? Since Anne mentioned question two, we could move on, or we can stay on question one if people have more that they want to say or offer. Over.
Hey, Stephanie, this is Seth. Can I say something?
Go for it.
I mean, I'm still not convinced that the contradiction between the two sentences in the first question is resolved. I mean, is it not possible that Engels wasn't, you know, maybe just a step behind Marx at that point? Maybe he just hadn't developed as far as Marx. I mean, Engels does say in that last second to last paragraph that with the ceasing of the means of production by society, production of commodities is done away with, and simultaneously the mastery of the product over the producer. But the thing is that he doesn't give any indication as to how the ceasing of the means of production would do away with commodity production. And the other thing is that commodity production and domination by dead labor, they don't seem to be given any particular priority in Engels' account, right? They're just part of this sort of laundry list of things that follow from the ceasing of the means of production. You know, like mastering nature and separating man from animal and so forth, all of which has a very 19th century ring, but you know, it's another matter. Over.
Thanks, Seth. You brought up something interesting for me personally, or politically personally, whatever, but if there's anyone else that wants to comment before I do, please speak up.
Peter Jones.
Peter, okay, but we're going to mute you, right? Or Will, you're going to not take Peter, correct?
Yep, if he's talking now, I'll pause it.
Okay, I'm going to say over and mute myself. Who else? Because I'm burning to speak, but I'll wait. Over.
Tulev?
Sorry, go ahead, Tulev.
Yeah, well, I think seizing control over the state is just a first step. That's sort of an enabling condition to do all the other things that Andrew and Anne have mentioned. That's over.
Thanks, Torev. Anyone else? All right, then I'm calling on myself quickly, and I'll be brief. I'm going to read what I wrote, and then I'm also going to address quickly the stuff that I want to respond to what Seth said as best I can. It's possible Engels meant that during the transition period in which the proletariat had seized control of the means of production, the state as it formerly operated and was understood no longer stands because it is now the end of the old order in which the bourgeoisie owned the means of production and they and their administrative class wield power over the proletariat. Now the proletariat create a reality in which state power becomes a tool in their own hands, which they use while there are still existing classes to keep their own power over the bourgeoisie in order to move society into a classless condition, hence abolishing the necessity for a state. The state is, in either case, a tool for maintaining power over. When there are no classes, there is no need for such a tool. The state as state then ceases to exist. Transformation, this is a comment, transformation into either joint stock or into state ownership is only a reformist program under the old capitalist order. It retains the hierarchies and managerial and all competitive conditions for workers under capitalism. I'm going to try to remember what it was that Seth brought to mind. And Seth, if you want to chime in or somebody else wants to remind me at some point, if I leave something important out, please do so. It was something about competition and sort of the framework in which Engels seems to be speaking or writing, I'm not sure that he was, because I don't have all this theoretical and historical background, I think he was kind of on the same page, pretty much at the same place where Marx was. But the first step had to be the seizing, the first revolutionary step has to be taking over the means of production. And once the means of production is taken over by the proletariat, all those marketing demands and the competition and all that other stuff and the fetishizations of things stops immediately, because the means of production, when it changes hands that radically or that revolutionarily, it's no longer the means of the way things are produced, and the reasons why they are produced are for necessary reasons and for life supporting reasons, not for making profit. And I'll stop there. Over.
Stephanie, it's Paul.
Go ahead, Paul.
I think one of the comments you made points to another tension here that needs to be resolved. And that is, on the one hand, Engels talks as if what happens is the proletariat seizes the state and then needs to hang on to the state in support of its own power, because it has to continue to fight against the previously existing classes. But at the same time, he seems to talk as if the sort of event that he's describing is one that can only take place if and when classes are abolished and the means of production and forces of production are revolutionized. And I think that's why we're having trouble figuring out what the order of events is supposed to be. It seems to me traditionally the idea was that the order of events was that the proletariat seizes state power. And then, at that point, you still have class antagonisms, and then somehow the proletariat goes about abolishing all of those things that are associated with capitalist production relations, thereby doing away not only with capitalism, but with all the antagonistic classes. If it were to work the other way around, if you were first going to take control of the means of production and do away with capitalist elements and class antagonisms, I don't see why you would need to seize control of the state. So I'll leave it there. Over.
Thank you, Paul. Anyone else?
Mike, I'd like to speak for a second.
Sure, I'll turn off. Sorry, go ahead, Mike. Over.
I'd like to move away from the question of the state seizing control over anything and bring it to what Engels is talking about, maybe a bit further up from the end. He talks about the role of the socialized organization of production and the contradictions within capitalist production. And at the end of the paragraph that starts, the fact that the socialized organization of production within the factory has developed so far that it's become incompatible with the anarchy of production in society. In that paragraph, at the end, the last couple of lines, he writes, on one hand, therefore, the capitalist mode of production stands convicted of its own incapacity. He's talking about crises to further direct these productive forces. On the other, these productive forces themselves, with increasing energy, press forward to the removal of the existing contradiction, to the abolition of their quality as capital, to the practical recognition of their character as social productive forces. Question here is, for me, is he talking about destruction of value, or is there something here that he's talking about in this sort of, I don't want to say mechanistic, but outside of the realm of proletarian human activity that capitalism itself, the productive forces itself, is sort of pushing the question? Because the next paragraph he says, this rebellion of the productive forces, as they grow more and more powerful against their quality of capital, the stronger and stronger command that their social character shall be recognized forces the capitalist class itself to treat them more and more as social productive forces. So I'll stop here and just kind of throw that out there. Over.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mike. Please, someone respond.
This is Brendan.
Okay, Brendan, go.
I believe to get to Mike's question that Marx is that Engels is arguing that the development of the productive forces in the development of the productive forces, the social nature of production is more and more realized as combinations increase and the interconnection of the division of labor through a larger and larger network of factories and production and it requires more and more control and planning that the social nature of production becomes more and more apparent, and that the things the state is doing to try to manage that become revealing of the latent sort of communist potential within those productive forces. But I don't know if, Mike, that might not satisfy. Maybe there's something more that he's looking for in an answer. And while I'm here on the microphone, I'm intrigued by. I just wanted to respond to Seth's suggestion that Engels might be behind Marx on this. I'm intrigued by that, and I could definitely see that as a possible way to read this text and read this question. I'm curious if Seth or anyone else has and I hope this isn't too off topic, but has a thought about the claim that Engels makes in the introduction to Anti-During that he has read the text aloud to Marx and that Marx is in full agreement with the text. I know there's a lot of discussion on other issues of dialectics and things about Engels and Marx, that this text is sort of a departure from Marx, and I haven't really, you know, read all that literature and all the arguments, but I'm curious if on this issue or just in general, and the book in general, if someone has a response to this claim by Engels that he and Marx are in total agreement on these issues, and that Marx has heard the text. Over.
Thank you, Brendan. Anyone want to comment here? Over.
Stephanie, I've spoken before, but can I say something on this?
It's fine with me if it's fine with everyone else. Go ahead. Over.
There's on that point, actually, that was mentioned, and all, the quotation I gave from the second to last paragraph from, the text that we were reading, it says, there's quite an funny little phrase, it says, in proportion as anarchy and social production vanishes, the political authority of the state dies out. Now, I don't know whether Engels was exactly on the same page as Marx or what, but that is a very interesting phrase. Whether it's badly phrased, I'm not really sure. But it implies, in proportion, I mean, I think Peter Jones mentioned something about, it talks, really, that's competition. The anarchy is the competition, maybe not just competition, but it says, in proportion as the anarchy vanishes, which implies that value production may not, in Engels' opinion, disappear instantaneously, because there'll be a dying out process. Or, I mean, have I read that wrong? But it just appears that sentence, I think it's the second last sentence in the second last paragraph, I'll read it again. In proportion as anarchy and social production vanishes, the political authority of the state dies out. So that's another, maybe another, you know, whether, I mean, I don't know, no one will know whether they were exactly on the same page. And maybe it is the correct, maybe that is the correct interpretation is that value production cannot or will not or may not disappear, it will die out. So, I mean, that's maybe a big question there, but, and it's only one sentence, but anyway, I just wanted to come back on that. Over.
Stephanie?
Go ahead. Thanks, Peter, again, and Andrew, go ahead. Over.
Yeah, on Brendan's question about the supposed joint authorship of Anthony Dehring, I would suggest that you read Terrell Carver on this issue. He has a small book called Engels. He's got papers on this. This is from decades ago. And he calls that into question due to primarily lack of any independent verification. You know, I think he went through all the Marx Engels correspondence that's extant and forth. And you know, clearly some of Anthony Dehring is marked, but the question is whether the whole of it is or not, and I think there's good reason to think that it's not. I happen to agree with Seth. I don't think there's anything wrong with what Engels is saying. It's just it doesn't reach the precision of what Marx is saying, and it leads to the kinds of problems that we're grappling with in this question. And on, I can't remember, I guess it was Mike's question very briefly. I agree with Brendan's response. Basically, what Engels, I think, is talking about is what Marx referred to as the abolition of the capitalist mode of production within the capitalist mode of production itself. And he's already seen that monopolization, you know, the joint stock companies and so forth, and just the crises of the credit markets is forcing capital itself to become socialized. You know, for instance, at moments of crisis. So I think that's all he's saying, although he's got a rather flowery style where it makes it look like he's maybe saying more. Over.
Thank you, Andrew. And it turns out Thoraf and I both have the same question. Would you mind, Andrew, providing the full reference of the book that you mentioned? Over.
Ruchira says she has it, so maybe somebody can do it. Steffi, we really need to move on. I'm sorry to be bossy, but we've used up 3/4 an hour on the first question, and I really think the other questions may clarify some of the sort of fuzziness or fogginess or whatever that Anthony Dehring has produced. Over.
That's fine, and I need to be bossed, or maybe I just need to be bossy. So if everyone's in agreement, we'll move on to question number 2. And before I say over, if I can also get feedback, should I not bother to read the question out loud, or is that helpful, or is that just taking up time? Over.
Read it out, please.
Okay, then who is willing to respond first? Over.
I'm sorry, did that person say leave it out or read it out? I thought he said read it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I heard
leave, I don't know.
I heard leave it out. Sorry.
I like the sound of a human voice with a question.
Okay, I will go with that unless I hear a huge clamor quickly to not do that. I will read it then. Over. Not over. I'm the reader. Sorry. Okay. Engels writes, as soon as there is no longer any social class to be held in subjection, a state is no longer necessary. It dies out. In the CGP, Marx writes that between capitalist and communist society, there lies the period of the revolutionary transformation of the one into the other. Corresponding to this is also a political transition period in which the state can be nothing but the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. Assuming that the two quotations above can be put together, what do they jointly imply regarding the non-existence of social classes and of the state, one, during the period between capitalism and communism, and two, during the lower phase of communism? Over. It's okay if people who've already spoken chime in to answer, because we want to move along. So, and people who haven't spoken yet will be prioritized as we go along. I'll be sensitive to that. Over.
Stephanie, it's Paul.
Go for it, Paul.
Again, as I was saying before, if Engels suggests that the state is no longer necessary, when there are no longer any social classes, but that at the beginning of the process, the proletariat has to be organized as the state, then presumably social classes still exist, and the transition out of capitalism hasn't taken place, at least fully, yet. So again, it seems to me that there's a political component, if I can call it that, that comes first, and an economic component that comes second, although, of course, the entire process can't take place unless and until the productive forces developed within capitalism make it possible for this sequence to occur. Over.
Oh, sorry. Go for it, Shane, if you're ready. Go for it.
I've always read it as, or understood it as, you know, the sort of seizure of power and then the delivery of the economic changes. That's, you know, been my understanding of it as a sort of activist for a long time. But the more I read this and rethink about it, the more even though I think Engels could put it a bit more clearly, I do think when it says between capitalist and communist society there's a period of revolutionary transformation, I think that's economic transformation. I think he sees something happening in the economy with forces and relations of production and those things sort of leading to objective socialization that can then when the proletariat seizes power, it abolishes, it makes manifest the fact these economic changes have occurred, and there's a period of struggle where there's a political fight to be had. So the economic transformation is about the abolition of classes and the dying out of the state as we move from capitalism to communism, which is a completely different kind of thing. But in the early stages, what we would call the state will be used as a public power to take over the means of production and to bring everything under a common plan and to resist the, you know, those who want to restore the old order. But I think it's really much more about that economic transformation than a lot of this, the way it's phrased, or the way we've always read it, at least, about, you know, seizing power and then delivering the economic changes. Over.
This is Anne.
Go ahead, Anne.
Yeah, I agree with what Shane just said, much more than with what the other people have said. Okay. This is Marx here, not Engels now, but the quote from the Critique of the Goethe program. And unfortunately, he doesn't make it crystal clear there either. So that's why we have these other readings as well, which it becomes clearer and clearer. But certainly, Marx is saying throughout that there has to be a complete break with capitalism. We're not talking about, you know, how many minutes between one thing and another, right? We're not talking about actual time here. We're talking about the change of social relations and the order of them. And I agree that it's only after capitalism is abolished and the workers are creating totally different human relations and different ways to work and how and a way to work without value production, that's the big break. That's the end of capitalism. That's the beginning of the establishment of socialism. But it's not a little bit socialist. This came up earlier, right? And I said that always reminds me of a little bit pregnant. You can't have one foot in both modes of production at the same time. Now, you do have two classes warring under capitalism, and the capitalists are not just going to go away and give up the second that the workers cease the means of production. So you have a period in which it's necessary to have this dictatorship of the proletariat as you know, a word that's turned out to be unfortunate because of its 20th century connotations. Engels calls it, where is this, somewhere in the questions, Engels calls it, well, the proletariat organized as the ruling class. In other words, we're switching ruling, who's ruling over whom. So now the proletariat has control of production. The state, its control of the state follows from that because it's now the dominant class. And then when it's gotten rid of the threat of capitalism returning, then it no longer needs the state because the state's only there to enforce the will of the ruling class. First the capitalists, now the proletarians. So we don't need it for very long. Again, these are conceptual long and short. I don't mean actually the number of days. But as soon as the classes are abolished by the situation, then you don't need the state. So the only reason it's complicated here is because of, I think, because of the centuries of people putting all their emphasis on seizing political power and thinking that has to be first and thinking that everything else flows from that rather than the causal, crucial main act being the changing of production relations. So that's why I guess it's hard to read, or maybe it's the language or whatever, but certainly there's a difference between saying transformation, which is when society completely changes its mode of production, and a political transition that's just a temporary measure going till the state dies out. But capitalism's not going to die out, you know. It has to be uprooted totally. So that's a transformation. I'm talking too much over.
Thank you, Anne. Anybody else who wants to speak on this question? The only anxiety I'm feeling is that we have 9 questions to answer this week. It would be great to address them all somewhat. And if anyone else has anything they want to say on 2, I'm not going to cut off conversation. Over. Okay, I didn't hear anyone respond, so maybe we can move on to question 3.
Stephanie?
Oh, sure. Andrew, go ahead.
I'll be very brief. I mean, I just want to sort of like answer the question directly and simply. During the period between capitalism and communism, Classes have not been done away with. They still exist, and so estates still exist. That's, as I understand it, what he's calling the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat, Marxist. During the lower phase of communism, it's a classless society, and there is no state. Over.
Great. That was very concise. Are folks ready to move on to question three? If I don't hear anyone speak up after I mute, I'm going to assume that and re-unmute, and we'll go to question three. But I'll give you a couple seconds. Anyone wants to speak up? That was 3 seconds. Okay, so we'll go on to question three, and I will read that. Oops. Okay, how does the conspectus clarify the meaning of the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat, called there the proletariat organized as the ruling class? According to the conspectus, exactly how long will that state exist? Over. Anyone? Otherwise, I'm ready. I've got something anyway, but I'll wait till somebody else speaks up first. Over. Okay. I guess I'll go ahead. Marx clarifies dictatorship of the proletariat is necessary while a ruling class remains. This would be during a revolutionary transition period in which the proletariat, already having seized control over the means of production, seizes government power and must act to force the transformation from the extant class-based society into a classless one. The proletariat must employ forcible means, hence governmental means. He writes of either pushing the old order with its economic conditions out of the way, or transforming it and hastening its transformation with force into a society based on a new order. Bakunin appears to be stuck in viewing Marx and LaSalle lumped together as advocating for, in his, this is in quotations from Bakunin, the foundation of a people's state with the proletariat organized as ruling class. Bakunin states that the proletariat would organize and rule over another remaining proletariat. Marx was describing a revolutionary period of transition. Bakunin was saying that Marx was positing a recapitulation of the old order, maybe initially turned on its head, but in the end still class-based, with a class at the top ruling over a new proletariat at the bottom, a changing only of positions, not of fundamental conditions. Marx says that Bakunin might understand political phrases in reference to social revolution, but that he has no comprehension of its economic conditions. Marx sees Bakunin's vision as bound by what Bakunin called the people's will and ignoring the economic conditions that create the social revolution. So Bakunin, the anarchist, becomes the gatekeeper of the people. There is no need for him to go on about the recreation of a new ruling class. Ironically, Bakunin, the anarchist, and those who devised the Gotha program remained trapped in arguing as if Marx wanted to continue statism. They conflated the word people with the word state, according to Marx. They are not one and the same. The state is a bourgeois institution used administratively and coercively to ameliorate class antagonisms under capitalist rule. Marx's view of the state as dictatorship of the proletariat is a practical revolutionary one, which sees state power as necessary to suppress the reestablishment of the old order at bay. And for maintaining proletariat power over the old ruling class until such time as all classes in society have disappeared and the state is no longer necessary. Over.
Shane.
All right, Shane, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that basically covered the question. I just felt a little bit of sympathy with Bakunin in here. I know he confuses Marx and LaSalle, but given the conversation that we've just been having about exactly how this works, and given the way certainly the sort of state socialists like LaSalle and the Labour parties, you know, delivering socialism by, you know, getting elected and then bringing socialism in, or indeed in Russia with the party seizing power and then delivering socialism and a new class or caste emerging, I felt like Bakunin had said, you know, the way it played out, I think Bakunin's suspicions might have been correct. And given that we're grappling with, well, how does the economic transformation fit with the political transition, you know, maybe there was something to that. We need to be really clear that we're talking about economic changes that then manifest in changes, and there might be a period of transition, like a political struggle over it, but it really is about that economic change, and those things have to happen first. They can't be just, you can't just seize the bourgeois state and, you know, deliver socialism to the people, as it were. So it was easy to see, particularly in LaSalle's case, why Bakunin might say, hey, you're just talking about seizing power, and then, yes, well, and your good people are going to deliver this to the good people, and the peasants will be oppressed, and the petty bourgeois will be oppressed by this new, you know, proletarian state. Over.
Thanks, Shane. Anyone else? Over.
Dave?
Okay, Dave, go ahead. Over.
I'm having trouble trying to imagine the power of the working class that allows it a kind of a class victory over the bourgeoisie in the way that it's being described. What I mean by that is that there have to be material conditions to permit the seizure of state power in the first place. So you can't just seize state power. You have to be able to back that up, and you have to already, in a sense, be the dominant class in the way that the bourgeoisie already materially dominated over the aristocracy before it took control of the state as part of the bourgeois revolution. So we've already heard about how the proletariat, the more it produces, the more it's alienated from that which is produced, and therefore the more it produces, the more it loses power. So there has to be some kind of mechanism by which the proletariat then turns that into an accumulation of power instead of a deterioration of power. Now what we hear is that we have the socialization of production, and the role of the capitalist socially becomes thinner and thinner. And while that has a kind of logic to it, it doesn't seem to me that that has been kind of borne out in history, insofar as, you know, we've gone from the scale of socialization to the scale of globalization, and it doesn't seem to have given the proletariat power over the bourgeoisie. Over.
Thanks, Dave. Anyone else? I'm just reminding folks that I myself am mindful of the fact that it's already 4:05 in Minneapolis time, which means we have about 55 minutes on the clock to get through all these questions. So anyone else want to speak on question, whatever, which one are we on? Three.
Stephanie, I'll be brief, I swear. I just want to say I think Shane answered Dave's question, that it's the proletariat's seizing the means of production that changes everything. They don't, that then they can have control of the state too. It flows from that, but there's nothing mysterious about the proletarian taking control of the means of production. Nothing would get rid of capitalism more simply than if everyone in the world went on strike on the same day, and there was no way to hang on to their control because they had no workers. That's how it happens, and question of does someone come either from the outside or from the inside and seize political power and then allow the workers to free themselves, or do the workers do the whole thing themselves through their relationship to the means of production? And let me also just, if I confused anyone by saying we're not talking about days and minutes here, and then when the question says exactly how long will the state exist, it's sort of a trick question, because the answer is it'll exist as long as there are classes. and their classes, you know, as long as there's exploited labor. But as soon as we've changed the mode of production, then, well, not as soon as, oops, again, don't mean about time. When we have changed the mode of production and eliminated exploitative labor, then we've eliminated classes. And then we don't need the state. Over.
Great. Anyone else?
Hi, Stephanie. This is Richard. I'll take 2 seconds.
That's fine. Take as long as you need. Over.
I think it's very damaging to, you know, talk about the seizure of political power before an economic transformation, because what always ends up happening, and has happened every time, is that you end up having communist parties trying to develop capitalism. This whole stage theory thing creeps in. And it becomes a real mess. Like, instead of that, why can't we just start living the way in which we want to live? Like, you know, cooperatives. I mean, if everyone can't go on strike at the same time, at least we can, you know, get together and start going through production our own way. And, you know, the whole idea of let's wait for the revolution, or let's wait so that we can go and seize political power and then we will transform all our economic transformation and try to eliminate classes. It never happens. Every time we try to do that, we end up perpetuating the same old past structure over.
This is Stephanie. I'm just going to respond very quickly, because Anne gave us, and we've been, thank you, Ruchira, but Anne gave us a little bit of guidance for her, Marx and Engels both also did. I think the problem is we can't have, I'll just say this, we can't just have socialism in one nation state or one geographic area. It has to be worldwide. I'm going to stop now and ask anyone else who wants to comment on this question to go ahead. Otherwise, we're going to move to 4.
Can I say something? It's the revolutionary dictatorship. Why are Marx and Engels kind of so hazy about what the revolution itself looks like? And I don't think it will be on the same day. It won't be one day. I mean, it's not like, you know, the 7th of November in Russia was the revolution. It took place over, you know, from February through to November. And all revolutions are like an unfolding process. So I think it's impossible to say exactly what will happen. You know, I mean, it may take the form of like a, because Anne said a strike or something, but that won't be the end of it. That will be the start of it, and that's where this revolutionary dictatorship will come in. Because I mean, we know the capitalists will fight tooth and nail, and all their agents are going to fight tooth and nail. So whatever happens in that intervening period from when there's a strike on day one to there will be, I mean, I don't think people are going to be too much at work. They're going to be too busy, you know, fighting off, you know, attempts to seize back control of the means of production or the state and so on. So we don't really know. And that's the problem is we don't know, we can't know what that process will look like. But if you look at revolutions, they're relatively short, but it's maybe like a year where you have all kinds of convulsions. So you have like the Portuguese Revolution. Again, it took a year for that finally to be kind of defeated. But I think, you know, within that year, God knows, who knows what will take place within that year. And I think even Marx and Engels didn't know. But I think, so to come back to the question, is that, you know, I think Marx was talking about, I think, is the dictatorship of the proletariat, which will be, you know, no one knows what that will look like, but it will have to involve some degree of force, you know, organizes the ruling class. And if you're organizing the ruling class, you've got to be doing the same stuff that the ruling class are trying to do to you, to back to them, because they're trying to do us over every day, and we see this force being used on a monumental scale across the globe. So hopefully it will be short and it will be relatively peaceful. Well, whether it will or not, we don't know, but so I think Marx was preparing us for that particular that conflict. Over.
Thank you, Peter. Is everyone okay if we do move on to four, or if somebody has really something else they want to say on three?
Stephanie, I'd like to say something on this question in regard to the point that Ruchira made, if there's time.
Sure, it's fine with me. I'm going to say yes and over.
I think one of the most important, perhaps the most important point Marx makes in the conspectus is his statement about willpower. He critiques Bakunin on the grounds that he, by he I mean Bakunin, doesn't understand the economic requisites of a social revolution, or rather that Bakunin doesn't, it's not that he doesn't understand them, but they just don't exist for him. Marx writes, and this is a quote, that willpower and not economic conditions is the basis of his social revolution. So here Marx, he's critiquing Bakunin for thinking that a European social revolution resting on the foundations of capitalist production is possible at the level of a pastoral society. But I think that this critique carries over more broadly, and that the conception that it's not a matter of will or politics, but rather economic relations and conditions, that underlines Marx's whole conception, and you just can't get away from it. I mean, his whole conception of the dictatorship of the proletariat and the transformation from capitalism to communism is dependent upon a transformation in economic relations. The end of class domination in the dictatorship is predicated not on willpower politics, but ultimately a change in production relations. But it's true of everything. I mean, in other words, those workers, they have to find a way to break with value production. You know, so that one person's hour of labor is equivalent to the other person's hour of labor. And I think, you know, that kind of transformation, right, I mean, that has to take place. Sorry for being so inarticulate, but over.
This is Stephanie. I don't think you were inarticulate at all. Anybody else, or shall we move on to four? Because I think as we progress through these questions, we're going to be sort of, you know, answering lots of elements of the previous one. So shall we move to four, or anyone else on three? Over. Okay, we'll move to four. In the Poverty of Philosophy, Marx writes, does this mean that after the fall of the old society, there will be a new class domination culminating in a new political power? No. The condition for the emancipation of the working class is the abolition of every class. Assuming that this statement can be put together with the one from the CGP quoted in question two, what do they jointly imply regarding A, when the old society is fallen, and B, when the working class has emancipated itself? Choices are, one, during the period between capitalism and communism, two, during the lower phase of communism, and three, during the higher phase of communism. I think this is going to answer a lot of what Ruchira, as well as others, have brought up. Over. Who's next?
Peter Jones.
Okay, Peter, just a minute before I'm sure Will, you're ready to mute the, anyone else. Over.
Torev?
Go ahead, Torev.
Yeah, I just want to be very brief on both points. I do agree with the previous speaker. So in my own words, is part A, when the old society has fallen, means the point when private ownership of the means of production is abolished, and therefore the two classes of capitalist and wage earner no longer exist. And part B is, I also think, the point in time is during the lower phase of communism, because there is a half sentence which summarizes it all, and I quote, "The conditions for the emancipation of the working class is the abolition of every class." Well, and as already been said, that can only be during the lower phase of communism. Over.
Thank you, Thoraf. Anyone else? Over. One more time, I'll put a call out for others, especially those who haven't spoken much or at all today, or responded, for question four. Otherwise, we're going to move on to five. Over.
Can I just say something very briefly?
Yes, you may. Over.
Yeah, I agree with these answers, and I would just like to remark that they go against about a century of tradition. Over.
Oh, wow. But I'll need more information on that personally, politically, later maybe. But anyone else want to speak on this, or shall we go further down the line now to the next question? Over.
Well, Peter Jones, just briefly.
Right on. Okay, thank you. Anyone else on this?
Yeah, Shane.
Go ahead, Shane.
Yeah, I guess it's all a bit sort of controversial. I don't have any problem with Andrew's expression that of his version of what is the standard tradition. It's certainly what I was taught in Trotskyist groups in Australia. So not the IS tradition, but the whatever tradition the DSP was in here, the Fourth International, but the I think just in terms of how Stephanie phrased it, I wonder if some of the things about, you know, we have this idea of the bourgeoisie, you know, using the state in an instrumental fashion. They use it to maintain their rule, and therefore, if you think of it that way, it becomes possible to think of the working class somehow taking that over and using it for their own purposes. So perhaps it's that instrumental way of looking at it as the problem. But, you know, what maybe I've written, the state is an expression of class rule rooted in the mode of production. And so given that set of class relations, you get this kind of form of class rule. And if the working class were to find a way to change that mode of production and in effect run it for its own purposes, then that would change the nature of the state. You have a different kind of class rule, or what I think Dunayevskaya is calling a commune form of a non-state. It wouldn't really be quite a state in the sense that we understood it, but the thing is to think of the state as an expression of class rule rather than an instrument that somebody's got that they can use, you know, one class against another. I think that makes sense. Over.
Stephanie, this is Ravi. Can I say something here?
Yes, Ravi, go right ahead. Over.
I mean, I think the formulation of the state as a body of armed men, which essentially talks about it as a force for violence or coercion, in order to, as people have said, to maintain one class's rule. And in the case of the dictatorship of the proletariat, because it's supposed to be a form of society in which the conditions are already being laid down, the abolition of classes altogether, it is a form of state that is premised upon its own kind of obsolescence once the conditions for its existence have been removed, which was the whole purpose for bringing it about in the first place. So that's why its kind of own self-negation is part of the project from the outset of creating the conditions for society where it's no longer necessary. Over.
Great. Anyone else?
Okay. Steffi, we should probably
move to six.
Move a lot faster if we want to get through any of these. And also, can I just make a plea for the people who've not spoken? They're not many, but there's some to speak up. And maybe the rest of us can restrain ourselves, like me.
Oops. Sure. Anyone else on this question, or shall we next move to six? Okay, I'm moving to six. Many of Marx's works, including the CGP and Capital, have critique in the title or subtitle. The CGP, in particular, castigates what he regarded as distortions and misunderstandings of his ideas. Why? What light might his emphasis on critique and his rejection of the Gotha unification shed on his conceptions of the revolutionary process, the role of ideas within it, and the proper tasks for revolutionaries? How is this related to Dostoevsky's claim that what must tower above all struggles against exploitation nationally and internationally is the perspective of a totally classless society and her jamming together of the CGP and Marx's theory of permanent revolution? Over. Okay, for people who have not spoken as much as others, if you have something that you want to say, if the people that haven't spoken at all aren't going to speak up, I just want to make sure that we can move along. So I'm not going to say anything at this point, but that, over. Anyone have anything that they want to say about this or ask more questions about it for clarification purposes? Over.
Stephanie, maybe we should relegate this question to email discussion. If no one has anything they want to say right now, right? The email discussion doesn't have to be entirely separate to discuss this, because these are long questions, but I think they're important questions, and I'd like to address it not now, but maybe if we go on to seven and talk about the Paris Commune, which has obviously influenced Marx at the time he's writing the CGP, maybe it'll sort of illuminate some of these questions about what's a revolution and when do you know you have one. Over.
Okay, so being somewhat democratic, should we vote or not vote to go with Anne's suggestion? I'm fine with going with what Anne is suggesting, if other people are too, and we can move on to seven. Over.
Yeah, I'm happy to move on to seven. I'd like to suggest that we do carry on email, but can I ask people to think about their subject lines in the emails too, so it's a bit clearer what each email's about. Sometimes, you know, there's just that one heading all the time. So if we talk about question six, maybe we can head it up as question six, but I'm happy to move on.
Okay, hearing nothing else, then I'll read from anyone else objecting to doing so. I'm going to go to seven. Marx begins, part A of seven. Marx begins section three of the Civil War in France by hailing the March 18, 1871 spontaneous outburst that seized governmental power. But he immediately says, but the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. Why not, according to Marx? B, throughout this section, Marx praises the innovations that the commune began to implement. Name the ones he gives. C, he says a few pages in, this new commune, which breaks the modern state power, has been mistaken for a reproduction of the medieval communes. What happened to the old ones? How does this one differ? D, what was the commune's message to and relationship to the peasantry? Over.
Hi, Stephanie. It's Ravi. I'll come in on this if you like.
Great. That'd be wonderful, Ravi. Over.
I think that the whole sort of conception of the state is one in which it isn't just a neutral body or instrument that it's possible for anyone just to take up and use. The state is far more seen as something that develops in relationship to the society upon which it emerges. And so a capitalist state is the form of domination to guarantee capitalist relations, and it's not possible for a different class to come along and seize hold of that in order to push it in a direction or push society in a direction that it desires. So in that sense, I think Marx's idea of the state is that it's a body of armed men that is there to act in the interests and guarantee the relations of the ruling class in a way that's far more organically bonded to the society out of which it emerges, rather than necessarily something neutral that stands outside of society that can be just taken by anyone over.
Thanks, Robbie. Who's next? Please, people who haven't spoken much, if you have something to say, this is we're getting towards the end here, so please do it if you feel so inspired. Over.
Ralph, I'd like to give a few examples.
I think that would be great. Go for it. Over.
Yeah, Marx was very taken by things like taking away education from the bourgeois state and gave it to the people, but also made the clerks, or what used to be government officials, responsible for their action. And also the commune did away with all the inflated remuneration or pay. So the state officials now have to live on a working man's wage. Yeah, and when I read this, I was also quite taken by this, because our states could learn quite a bit from those innovations. Over.
Anyone else? Thanks, Torav. Okay. if it's okay with everyone, if there's consensus, then we'll move on to question eight, although I think maybe people could go back and maybe we could have some emails back and forth about number seven if people want that. Shall I go on to read out eight, or is there more on seven? Over. Okay.
It's Stephanie? I'm sorry, it's Anne.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to go, I mean, since he writes this beautiful description, I'd like to go into it a little more because, you know, this is the main revolution on which all later proletarian revolutions, from which they get their impetus, I think, because in the commune they just began to redo everything. So, I mean, a main thing he cites is abolishing the standing army. That already changes everything when the people have the guns in their hands instead of the standing army. They threw the priests out of the churches and took over the churches as convenient public spaces to have meetings in and things. Someone's mentioned education workplaces. They had, you know, workshops all over. They had, this isn't all in here, but they had other communal laundries, kitchens, etc. Everyone should look for this book by Edith Thomas called The Women Incendiaries that details how the women remade all of life in the commune. The men were mostly all fighting the Germans. Anyway, Marx is very taken with this. It gives him a flavor of what's possible to do when the capitalists are off our backs. In this case, they fled Paris, and we're able to start remaking society. I'm not going to go into C and D because there isn't time, but I think it's very important to sort of get a feel for what that revolution did and how it influenced the critique of the Gothic program and sort of opening up possibilities for the future. Other things in eight, I'll wait for eight. I was going to cite the very thing that's the first line of question eight, but I won't. Over.
Okay, so if no one has any objections, we'll just segue right into question eight then. Thanks, Anne. Marx writes in the CWF, the great social measure of the commune was its own working existence. A, what does this mean? B, explicate his statement in CWF that the commune was the political form at last discovered under which to work under which to work out the economical emancipation of labor. At the end of the paragraph beginning, the multiplicity of interpretations to which the commune has been subjected. How did the commune differ from the Lasallian cooperatives that Marx criticizes in section 3 of CGP? Include in your discussion Marx's references to the iron law of wages and to democracy. Your time is running short. I'll skip this question and cover it in a later class. Sorry. Over. Anyone ready on this one, or because we're at like 17 minutes or so, over.
Peter Jones.
Okay. Will, you ready to turn him off or turn off the sound for him, the recording? You have reasons for not wanting to be recorded, but what everybody's saying, it would be great if we could, but I understand that it's not possible, and it's just a pity because it's pithy what you said. Anybody else want to say something on this, or shall we move on? Over.
To Ralph, I'd like to, say how important the commune was?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, there are several things in there, and I think that's the reason why Marx was so taken. I think it's the commune was proof that a non-capitalist society is actually possible, and it also, with these innovations we discussed earlier, the commune showed how the state could work. But that is not, and in relation to this, the commune was also proof that a classless society is possible. And that must not be underestimated. The importance of this must not be underestimated. Over.
Wonderful, thank you. Anyone else?
Yes, Stephanie.
Go ahead, Andrew, over.
Yeah, I think it's very important, this phrasing of Marx that's quoted in B, because, you know, some people have the tendency to think that the commune, you know, was itself a communist society, was itself a classless society. But Marx makes the distinction there. I think maybe Peter was referring to that. He makes the distinction between the political form that's been discovered and the economic, emancipation of labor. But he indicates there that the economic emancipation of labor still had to be worked out. And so there is still that, so to speak, tension between these elements, and the politics of the situation are not determining of the end result by themselves. So I think it's important that it not be understood that, like, the uprising and working class power is itself a solution to all of our social problems. Without the change in the economic foundation of society. Over.
Great, thanks. Anybody else on question 8? Over.
Steph, yeah. Yet.
Go ahead.
I just want to point out the whole commune only lasted 2 months before it was smashed. So, there's no way it was going to effectuate communism, and the fact that it has this glorious moment in history doesn't mean, that we know what it could have achieved if it went on. So, but I agree that the emphasis here is on the political form. They had figured out a way to free the creativity of people, put everybody into administrative posts, etc. Change so many things around. When Marx says the greatest social measure of the commune was its own working existence, I think he means just that they were able to survive by working cooperatively and taking over all the functions of society, not of the state, who cares about that, but of the society. And they worked together, and they survived as long as they could, and they made things better, and so there we are, over.
Thank you. I think, Paul, maybe you're next. I'd like to, just not to put you on the spot, Lucia, but I think maybe it would be great if you can also comment on this question at some point. Paul, did you want to be next, or anyone else? Over.
I'll give way to Lucia on this first.
Okay, so Ruchira, do you have something? Because I think this is right up your alley, but...
Since you're drafting her.
I'm not hearing anything.
Hi, this is Ruchira.
Go ahead. Okay.
Well, I am really just, I'm just a student, and I'm rethinking everything that's going on. So I still have a lot to read and understand about the Paris Commune and what it did. I enjoyed some of the points that were made, like in the sense what Anne said, that it, well, it may have lasted only 2 months, but it still was a way in which society, I mean, you know, the workers took over the over society, the means of production, rather than just the state, and that is what, I mean, that is what we're trying to do. But, yeah, it meant such terrible repression, and, well, that's what happens in revolution. It's just a constant dialectics. You find a new way of living, and then it threatens the old order. The old order tries to take you back, and then you try to create something again. So, yeah, it's a process. But I do think that cooperatives and taking over society rather than the state is the way to go. At least that's what I think now. I'm still thinking over.
Thanks, Ruchira. Paul, did you want to be next, or does somebody else who hasn't spoken much want to precede Paul in this one? I'll wait to hear, and if not, then Paul can go ahead.
Stephanie, I'd like to say something at some point on the part C of the question about cooperatives.
Okay, so Paul, do you want Seth to go now, or you?
Let me just say that I thought that Andrew's description of the commune was right on the mark. And, you know, we don't want to confuse, as he was saying before, the what is essentially a political transition, even though the political transition then attempts to implement certain kinds of measures that have an impact on the way the economic realm functions. We don't want to confuse the political step with the quote-unquote achievement of socialism. My concern is, and maybe this is really just a question for another time, my concern is I don't see how that's not the way the tradition has, for the most part, interpreted its own history. It seems to me that the remark about Lenin before doesn't make sense either, and is in contradiction to what Andrew has just said about the commune, because I don't think Lenin thought that simply by seizing state power that automatically created socialism. So I mean, I'm just a little confused about all of this, but maybe it's something left, you know, better for another day. Over.
Thank you, Paul. I'm just going to say at this point, because we're almost at the end, maybe this would still, what you just brought up, Paul, would be better clarified in an email communication. Can we go over to what Seth wants to bring up before, because we're running out of time. Is that all right? Seth, you ready?
Yeah, okay.
Everyone okay with that? Okay, here you go. Over.
Well, I mean, I found the part C of this question especially interesting, given the present renewal of interest within the left in you know, worker-run cooperatives and worker self-management. Experiments, you know, like Mondragon in Spain, or the stuff in Caro, like the coffee house cooperatives. The Lascellian cooperatives that Marx he critiques in the CGP, they're formed with state aid, and he says it's that I'm trying to find the quote. He says that it's worthy of LaSalle's imagination that with state loans one can build a new society just as well as a new railroad. And of course, in sharp contrast, the cooperatives in the Paris Commune appear to have risen spontaneously, and as a result of sort of independent initiative of workers and other actors within the commune. I think that's likely. It was likely something very similar to what happened in the beginning of the Russian Revolution. You know, where workers began running factories themselves, at least until not only the Civil War intervened, but also Lenin and the Bolsheviks intervened and put a stop to it, and you know, kind of quelled independent worker initiative more broadly. hit something else. I think there's another issue involved with the cooperatives aside from worker initiative. In the reading on the commune, Marx describes cooperative production as a sham and a snare. It's a quote, a sham and a snare. There's something operative in Marx's construction, but I think what's underlying things, although he doesn't explicitly say this, but I think what's underlying things is that he sees cooperatives and cooperative production, that they don't in themselves constitute an alternative to capitalism, and they don't constitute a path to a new society in and of themselves. That is, if cooperatives are not germane sham and a snare, as Mark puts it, we need to see entirely new production relations emerge. I mean, in other words, without a break with value production, no matter how democratic or, you know, how well-intentioned people they may be, the cooperative producers, they'll ultimately be forced to conform to the dictates of the market, right? Or otherwise, they're just going to face bankruptcy. Over.
Great, thanks, Seth. I'm going to put it out there. Everybody knows that we're 2 minutes from stopping officially, and we still have. I'm sure people have tons of stuff that's going to come up for the most of the questions we've covered so far, and we haven't even gotten to nine. So, can I get a little bit of input from people about what we want to do next? Over.
Stephanie?
Yes, Andrew, go ahead.
I think this is an important question. I mean, especially because it's been brought up and it's a genuine thing on people's minds, including Ruchira. So I would like to stay with this a bit. I have a bit to say on it, if I may.
Great. I'm fine with it myself, but anybody else, if anybody, let's just go with it now, and if people need to say bye, if things are taking too long, just farewell us on Skype. Okay? We'll go now. I'm going to say over.
Yeah, to kind of give an illustration of Seth's point, and he mentioned the Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque region of Spain. I always wondered how they dealt with like fluctuations in demand and, you know, the amount of business that they had. And I discovered that what happens is there are people who are members of the cooperatives, and there are people that they hire who are not members of the cooperative. And those people who are not members don't have the same right. So if this were the form of a new society, we would immediately have a two-class minimum society. And what they do in Mondragon, well, before the latest crisis, even their own members are unemployed. But what would happen prior to that is, when business was slow, the members of the cooperatives would be still employed, but at least some of the temporary workers who are not members, they would be thrown onto welfare. So it was up to the Basque government to take care of them. So if the cooperative form were just extended without a change in capitalist production relations, we would still have the same problems of unemployment and people on welfare that we have now under standard capitalism. Over.
Thanks, Andrew, for speaking up. Anybody else on this? Should we continue? I, as I said, I'm willing to. So if people want to speak up, this is the time. Over.
Stephanie, Paul, I just wanted to say, sum up what Andrew said by suggesting that what it means is we can't have socialism in one cooperative. Over.
Sounds right on. Anybody else?
This is Ruchira.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, we can't have socialism in one cooperative, and when we do have socialism in one cooperative, well, the cooperative is having trouble because it can't fund itself, it can't finance itself, and then we are asking for state funding for cooperatives, and well, state is not going to listen to us because state is, after all, supporting the bourgeoisie because we're in capitalism. But well, it's still worthwhile maybe to, you know, try to push cooperatives as a way of taking over the means of production. Okay.
Certainly. Go ahead, Dave.
I think that the idea of the working class en masse seizing the means of production and seizing the state, it depends on earlier development. So it might well be that these collectives and also, you know, worker-run factories and so on and so forth might give the working class a sense that something more is possible, that they could take over the whole of society, not just this organisation or this factory and so forth. Over.
This is Stephanie responding to what you said. I didn't mean to imply that those aren't good models. It's the conditions have to be there in order for the masses to rise up in that way, of course, but over.
Can I have one word, Steph?
You can have more than one. Go
ahead.
No,
I've talked way too much, but I think we're sort of falling into the same problem that a lot of the email discussion is having. We're trying to rush to coming out with some kind of program or model or something out of Marx's basic concepts. And I think first we have to get down some basic concepts. So the issue with the co-ops that I think Seth initiated was, you know, is this sustainable change? Is this socialism? And if not, why not? And I'm sure that next week's class, Capitalist versus Communist Modes of Production, will help us clarify this a lot. But I think we shouldn't rush to, oh, does this mean my country or organization should be promoting co-ops? Over.
Okay, this is Stephanie. And I think maybe, well, I'm just going to put this out there, and maybe it's just redundant in terms of what you've just said, but maybe it would be good if you and Andrew could maybe put something out there very concisely, or maybe not so concisely, that helps frame the rest of the dialogue that we have, whether it's in these sessions via Skype and or on email, so that we have some guidance and framework from you, not telling us exactly what to do all the time, but giving us that I guess, for better lack of a better word, framework about what we're doing. Because I think maybe people, including myself, have misunderstood where it is that we're supposed to go. I mean, you know, you're not being fascist or whatever, but, you know, what it is we're supposed to be getting from this or developing out of this particular bunch of readings and discussions. Over.
Sure.
Stephanie?
Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I think the questions are meant to do that. So that if one does the readings along with the questions, you see, you know that what we're going to be focusing on is the questions, right? So if you do the readings along with the questions are rather more specific, and it's not just, you know, like 8 pages that you have to sort of like assimilate with another 14 pages and so forth. You can hone in on the particular issues. So I don't know what else you would be wanting in the way of guidance or direction. That's not provided by the question. Over.
Toralf?
Go ahead, Toralf.
Maybe as a suggestion, today I found there were maybe three questions too many. And the reading associated with going through all the questions, which I tried to do, I found a bit too challenging for this week. So I didn't have an answer to every question. I don't mean to say that I would have spoken up on every question, but what I like doing is exactly what Andrew suggested. I have the questions in a Word document, and right beneath the questions I put my answers. So, and as I said today, three questions may be too many, so I did struggle. Thank you, over.
Thanks, Torav. Anybody else? Okay, I'm just going to put this out there very quickly, because I think there were times maybe when people forgot to mute, people who weren't speaking maybe forgot to mute, because every now and then there was a little bit of fuzziness with sort of background noise. I wasn't sure what that was with people, but I could hear every word everybody said. The other thing is I sent an email Thursday or Friday in the wee hours of the morning in response and never heard back from anybody. And it also, but I got something back that made it seem as if it wasn't delivered at all. So it was on that thread that everybody's been commenting on. So I just want to know if anyone received it at all. And then this is not the time to help me out with the group response thing, which I haven't had trouble with before. But if somebody could, guide me in an email, let me know the best way to do that. Over.
And can I just ask, it sounds like we're just doing logistical stuff now. Should I stop the recording for this week?
It's fine with me if you stop it. Anybody else? Everybody else okay with that? Thanks, Will.